On behalf of Calibra and Carasoft, we would like to welcome you to today's podcast, focused around health transformation powered by data intelligence, where Dr. Barry Chaikin, the clinical chief at Tableau Software, Charles Gabriel, the project manager of standards and interoperability at the Federal Electronic Health Record Modernization, Cupid Chan, the BI and AI committee chair of LF Data and AI at the Linux Foundation, and Chris Cooper, the AVP of Health and Education at Calibra, we'll discuss how data intelligence has worked to power transformations within the healthcare industry.
Welcome everyone to our panel. I am Dr. Barry Chaikin, clinical lead at Tableau. I am thrilled to have such learned colleagues with me today. I'm going to start with Dr. Gabriel.
Hi, just wanna start with a disclaimer as a federal government staff. Just wanna for a second introduce the my organization, the Federal Electronic Health Record Modernization. The mission of the firm is primarily to implement a single common federal EHR to enhance patient care and provider effectiveness wherever the care is provided. Just want to share with you some of the scope of the firm. You can see about the firm kind of have a 46,000 community partners, about 200,000 beneficiaries plus 150 provider, 9 million eligible beneficiaries, and they have 11 million visits. That's the scope of the firm, which is involved DOD, VA, and US Coast Guard. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gabriel. I know you have done much work on artificial intelligence. Most of us who do not work in the field do not have a really good handle on what artificial intelligence is. Dr. Stephen Hawking warned us of the dangers of AI, and we have all seen too many science fiction movies that portrayed AI gone wrong and destroying all of human mankind. Can you share with us your perception of AI and ground us in a true picture of what it is and what it is not?
It's a very loaded question, and it's a very smart question. I think that the reality now is that there is a huge gap between what he envisioned and the current state of the AI. There's definitely a learning curve to catch in this very lofty vision down the road. But I think what he is trying to say, maybe at some point, when we have a smart city, when everything is based on automation and AI, as they intertwined together, maybe we need to make sure the management behind the scene will guarantee or ensure a quality outcome of the applying AI. But at this point, we have a long way to go until we reach this point. And in the meantime, hopefully we can train our workforce, the new generation, to manage such complexity.
Welcome, Mr. Chan. You have spent much of your career working with big data and AI. What do you see as the future of AI?
Well, like I know AI sometimes may give a very like a story and amazing impression of like it will change the world. But you know what? In my experience and perspective, I think this is yet another technology. What I mean is like think about as easy as a ball pen, right? When we first invented a ball pen, it was a technology. People really want to get one. And the technology really impacting human when it starts getting embedded in our daily life. And think about internet, it's the same thing. When internet first happens in the world, like invented in the world, company like all the internet company, right, start, and then they use internet as their core technology. But this technology really getting impact when it's embedded to right now, we actually rely internet as part of our daily life. And I believe AI is exactly the same thing. So AI really can impact us as a human being when we start not talking about AI anymore. That's the first point. And the second point, I think it's also very important. Think about all the technology that we have invented. No technology can be by themselves, be standalone. AI is the same. So that's why in my LinkedIn profile, you can see that I am an AI entertainer and blockchain adopter. So I call AI and blockchain the yin yang of the modernized technology. AI is something ever changing. If you have more and more data, the probability will change. It's probabilistic technology. But blockchain, on the other hand, once you enter a record, a transaction into a ledger, nothing can be changed from that point. So it's like the yin and yang. And the moment that we really combine this kind of technologies together, this is how we can leverage a truth technology and then unleash the power of AI. That's my point of view.
That's really, really very interesting. Do you see any obstacles to using AI fully?
Yes, of course. I think it's the mindset and the culture. If you don't have the good mindset and always think that this is kind of the technology will destroy the whole human being. Just like think about when we invent engine, right? In the Industrial Revolution, people may think, oh, that's not good because you're going to eliminate, for example, the whole job category, which may be true. But on the other hand, the opportunities that is bringing in by this engine is also tremendous. So same thing for the AI. I think we need to be aware, AI is just yet another technology. It's enabler for the true business that we are doing every day. The real necessity that as a human being we need will not change because of AI, but it is an enabler that will help human to live better in the future.
You know, as a child, I read a lot of science fiction, a lot of Isaac Asimov. It's really great to hear the two of you talk about the positive way about AI, because I was very much worried about it. And I trust you that it's going to bring some really great things into our lives, even beyond what it's already done. So thank you for that. I want to switch to Mr. Cooper. I know you've done a lot of work in the field of data governance. Is data governance important when trying to build a data-driven organization?
Thanks, Dr. Chaykin. Great question. We really look at data governance as the practice of managing and organizing data and process to enable collaboration and compliant access to data. Data governance allows us to use users to be creative in the value of data assets and how, under constraints of security and privacy, data can be effectively applied for AI, for new insights, for all of the capabilities that we all realize that data brings to our lives. But what we find is that too much of the focus around data is around the data management technologies. The key to becoming data-driven, whether that's through great analysis and visualization technologies, which are important, are platforms which are vast, which allow us to manage these vast stores of information, are absolutely critical. But just like dropping me behind the wheel of a Formula One race car isn't going to capture any checkered flags, we have to have the best technology aligned with the best process, the best skills, and the best resources. Data governance helps us unlock the potential of our people and our process and join that together with the data to make incredible breakthroughs. We don't have time for every data user to spend hundreds and thousands of hours to understand the technologies. Data governance provides us the guardrails to keep those rookie drivers, our data users, on track. So that we can get the most out of the amazing technologies that we're seeing, whether those are AI-based, our cloud data platforms, and the ability to bring together and drive out correlations across a data landscape that we haven't been able to see historically. At Calibra, we see data governance as the key to unlocking data intelligence. When data intelligence is that connectivity of the right people, insights, process, and algorithms to allow our data users, what we call data citizens, to optimize the process, increase that efficiency, and really drive innovation. So we connect the data, the context, or the meaning of the purpose, the people, the process, often in the form of a policy, back to the meaning and the outcome that we're looking for. When we have that context around data, meaning, provenance, reason for that initial capture, we can really drive the insights that we're looking for from our data to transform our organizations.
I want to follow up on one thing. You mentioned the data governance and you mentioned the data culture. What about data literacy? Can you expand a little bit about what that is and what it means within the context of data governance and data culture?
Absolutely. You're exactly right, Dr. Chaykin. The key to unlocking the potential within our data is enabling that data literacy. We see data governance as the foundation for literacy. It is the book on the shelf. Our literacy is our ability to read that book and understand that content. So as we enable our users to become more data literate, we use the tools of data governance to provide the context, the definition, the meaning, the provenance of where that information came from to help our users become more literate and understand appropriately how they can apply those data insights.
I have to tell you, at my time at Tableau, I've obviously thought about data governance, data culture, data literacy. But really what I loved about your response is you were talking about data literacy is being able to read the book. And I thought that was a really fantastic metaphor for what data literacy is. So thank you so much for sharing that. If it's okay with you, I'd like to steal it and use it when I give my own talks. That was really, really fantastic. So thank you. I want to switch on to Dr. Gabriel again. I've heard about the Advanced Technology Academic Research Center. Can you share with us what that center is and what it does? Additionally, what federal initiatives are currently underway there to improve AI and ML?
There are two organizations who have several initiatives in promoting AI, machine learning, and predictive analytics. The first one is ATARC, and we will share the website with the audience. It's a chance and a channel for the industry, for government, individual to learn more about what's going on in acquisition in the federal government. And there are elite organizations participant in this endeavor, OMB, Secret Service, DOD, and several others. So this is the first one. Yeah, the second one, American Council of Technology. And again, we're going to share the websites. And they care about improving the acquisition process, the workforce, the training, even adding a job description to the new coming workforce and increasing the federal government knowledge and training around those areas. So we'll definitely share point of contact at the end of this discussion.
Dr. Gabriel, can you share with me some examples of the work that the center is currently engaged in and what you think the outcome of that work will be?
So the ATARC are writing a paper for the OMB to go over all the knowledge domain, job descriptions, qualifications, possible training, so the federal government can take a proactive action on promoting the workforce. We have a small community that we discuss how the leadership can manage the cycle of AI and make sure that the process will go very well. They also can accept out-of-the-box thinking. As you can imagine, this will require a lot of different leadership in the federal government and the organization involved. So there are very intensive discussion in the White House, the Congress, especially the White House, is taking a stake in this process. So there are many elite individuals from Harvard, from federal government are involved to shape the initiative. And again, on the second organization, they are American Council of Technology. They are involved in shaping the acquisition process for AI, robotic process automation, machine learning, and so forth and so on.
Mr. Chan, you and I were talking the other day, and you mentioned the term cognitive intelligence. I've heard of business intelligence, but what is cognitive intelligence?
Thanks, Dr. Chicken. You still remember what I told you. That's very good. But before I answer that, let me also share some like a past experience I had with Dr. Gabriel. Because back in 2017, this is actually the very second panel that I and Dr. Gabriel is in. Back in 2017, we were in another panel called CHITA, the Conference of Healthcare IT and Analytics. And in that panel, the moderator asked me, hey, Cupid, what do you think about the analytics in the next few years? Out of the blue, I said, okay, maybe it's the AI plus BI equals CI. So at that point, I literally Googled CI and cognitive intelligence and nothing there. So I can claim that I coined that term myself, but it's up to like whether Google's algorithm is precise or not. But what do I really mean by AI plus BI equals CI? AI, we all know that, machine learning and an algorithm. has a tremendous speed of learning something that no human being can ever at that speed of learning. You throw 1 terabyte of data to that algorithm. After an hour or so, you can find that AI algorithm will find a pattern for you. So that's the speed AI can provide. On the other hand, BI, it's very well known traditionally in the past 20 something years, is very well known to help human to intuit, to expose or unleash their intuition of the direction of the analytics. So think about the speed by the AI or machine learning and the direction that a BI tool can help a human being. Combine these two together, I call it as a cognitive intelligence. That's the real actual intelligence that we want, we human being wants as the destination of the analytics. But that's not the end. And you may have realized that in the marketing material, my title in this particular panel, I am the chair of BI and AI committees in Linux Foundation LF AI and Data. And one of the projects for this year, I am leading a project called OBAIC. So I spell it out as OBAIC. You may say, what is OBAIC? So you must heard about ODBC, right? ODBC is the a middle layer between the BI tool and the database. So that any BI tool coming in, they don't need to learn about an Oracle, SQL Server, Teradata, or anything. They just need to learn ODBC, that protocol. Because at that time, 30 years ago, database technology is so spread out, and we need a standard to make sure that when BI, when user coming in, they can talk to the same language. Fast forward 30 years today, you know what is blooming? It's AI. It's the framework. We have TensorFlow, we have Caffe, we have Keras, we have PyTorch, we have a lot of AI, and they are all open source platforms. If we want to talk of, or if BI want to talk to the underlying data frame, AI framework effectively, we need something very similar to ODBC for database. But this time is open business and artificial intelligence connectivity between the BI platform and the AI layer. And Linux Foundation, LF AI and Data, we are defining this layer this year with the leading partner. Tableau is one of them included. I'm talking to Tableau, Click, and the other MicroStrategy, all the other BI leader in the market to define that. And hopefully, after we've defined and implement this layer, we can then freely talk between BI and AI and really accomplish the CI, cognitive intelligence.
I want to go back to data governance for a moment. And the reason I want to do that is I think that you can't do effective business intelligence or any types of analytics unless you have a strong data governance structure. And it also has to be flexible and agile so that you can respond to the needs of the organization, whether it's a payer, provider, government, what have you. Even outside of healthcare, it's still important to have that very important data governance model and also to harmonize, et cetera. So I'm going to shift back to Mr. Cooper. Can you share with us the key factors that organizations should focus on to build a high-performing data governance model?
Absolutely. And the key to unlocking the value of data governance is to focus on your people. It's about thinking about the end in mind. What do your users need to understand about your data, your process, the context, and the meaning? How do we bring these together, and how do we assess? How do we form a structure of collaboration so that at the most simple layer, we can have a common understanding of the business concepts, the clinical concepts that we are speaking about, and how those relate and tie back to the data? It's incredibly important to think about how do we leverage technology to then scale that process so that we are minimizing the time spent on rote governance activities like inventorying data sets and classification. We want to apply the knowledge that we have and the participation we have to bring together the people around the concepts and the meaning that ultimately data governance is helping us connect back to our data and our AI models that we're trying to drive across the organizations.
Mr. Chan, you shared with me the term Beauty and the Beast while also linking it to the phrase drag and drop, okay? I suspect this has absolutely nothing to do with the animated film or play on Broadway, okay? So can you explain to me what you mean by those two phrases and linking them?
Sure. I just answered you about AI plus BI equals CI, right? But besides the speed and the direction that is shared, like the analogy for AI and BI, another thing that I can think of, it's the beauty and the beast. Think about the beauty first, right? In the past, again, 20-something, 30 years, BI has been evolved a lot from just a pie chart or line graph, very primitive kind of visualization to represent the data, to right now, the user can be very engaged by different visualization and the layout of the data. So BI has been like an expert in beautifying the data and present it to the users. So that's the beauty part. But think about, what is the beast? If you have just a pretty face sitting at the top, but you do not have the engine in the back, that's nothing. You really want to explore the data. And right now, I think we have already talked a lot about AI. What is that engine? What is that beast? Is the AI. There are a lot of open source framework, as I mentioned, TensorFlow, PyTorch, they are that engine, they are that beast. But how can this beast be user-friendly? So that's why I come up with the term Beauty and the Beast for this analytics, because I want people to understand you have the AI, which is good, but unless you can connect back to your users so that they can understand what is that particular AI algorithm is doing, it's useless. And so that's the reason why last year, so I mentioned that this year we do something called OBEIC, right? The ODBC, AI for ODBC, right? But last year, we actually did a white paper focusing on human-centered AI. How are you going to make AI be more human and put human in the center? And one point that I brought up in that white paper is not machine learning. It's machine teaching. And think about any successful school system, right? Of course, you go there to learn as a student. But on the other hand, you cannot forget about the teaching piece. And I think the machine teaching is also very important in the overall AI process. What do I mean by that? So if you think about the whole, the AI process right now, starting from collecting the data, cleaning the data, trying to form the model, all the way to deploy your data to the production, all different steps, you will find out that those steps are pretty siloed, pretty independent. And if you really want to put a human in the center, you want the human, we, to inject our knowledge back to the to each and different steps. For example, when we try to label the data, you can let the AI algorithm to actually run the first round. And if and only if that machine learning algorithm cannot really label that, it will come to you as a human, then you will help the algorithm to categorize or to label that data set. And then at the end, when you have the result of that model, you're trying to predict the result, but the machine learning algorithm is actually not very certain because the confidence index is very low. Then human should also come in to provide more information for that a result. And then you teach the machine and the machine would then learn from you. That is the iterative process that I can see. Again, by Beauty and the Beast, I think we really need to design the whole process, not only focusing on the underlying AI engine. We also need to focus more on how can we convey this message and this result to the user and interact between each other.
If I may comment on this, on his statement, this is very, very intelligent, and I like this a lot. Going back to the first question, Dr. Chaykin, when you asked me about that AI is going to take over the world and all the stuff. So his point, what he's saying is, AI is not doesn't have the absolute power to dominate the human. It has a certain focus, certain niche, and you're going to train the AI on a certain niche. So if you're going to train the AI to clean certain space, the AI is not going to grow and spread hurdles across the space that you asked it to do. It's going to be focused on specific things. So that's one factor. The second factor is the interaction between the human and the AI and the iteration. That's what makes the AI is valuable. That's where data governance can come in. Interpretation of the AI data in our world, in our evidence-based analysis, it has a big part of how would you interpret the data and what type of decision you're going to make. And that will, by itself, to some degree, is not going to make the AI dominant, period, unless we're going to have the smart city that I talked about in the beginning.
Mr. Chen, you mentioned the word beast, right? Well, when I think of the beast, I'm thinking of the challenges we've had in healthcare around interoperability. It's been a major challenge for a really, really long time. Work by the former ONC head Don Rucker and his team in setting federal rules has done much to enhance interoperability and limit data blocking. Knowing Mickey Tripathi, the new ONC head, I'm very confident he will do a fantastic job building upon Dr. Rucker's work. So Dr. Gabriel, considering the current state of interoperability, what types of obstacles still exist in preventing analytics? And what do you expect the future to look like as interoperability improves?
As you know, the good news, we had a good maturity in all levels, technology, process, semantic, and technical. So interoperability requires all those ingredients, if you will, to be mature over time. So it's kind of, we came a long way. So in terms of health, of course, interoperability in the context of health, we came a long way because it's easier in a different industry, different application. So definitely there are a lot of room for improvement, but we came a long way. We need to make sure when we have a workflow on the electronic health records, we can take this workflow and send it to system somewhere else, from system A to system B. We can tag this workflow. Maybe the system B would have the knowledge about if we just label this workflow enough or tag it enough, the system B will ingest the workflow and understand that this is for a lab order or a particular episode. If we send it and we are successful to send it to system B, the next level is, can system B take it inside and take it in within the system, regardless if the system is similar or not, can take it inside and translate that and ingest it and put it in a context and use it for something else. That's a second layer of interoperability. So we're still into the semantic layer. We came a long way in the technical, in moving data around, but ingesting and digesting is still a lot more to come.
Thank you. Mr. Chan, we know that EHR companies have some responsibility for the lack of interoperability. What do you think we need EHR vendors to do to open up access to the data within their EHRs? And why do you think they have been reluctant to date to accommodate the demands of their users?
Yeah, I think that very, very good question. But it's a good question, but it's not a hard question. If we think about, hey, Dr. Gabriel, I mentioned that we know each other since 2017, right? Can you open up your house for me? Or hey, Mr. Cooper, right? How about you? Can you open your house or maybe lend your car so that I can drive? And Dr. Chicken, same thing. Because what you own as a house, as a car, is your asset. It's something that you own. At least you believe you own it. This is exactly the same thing for EHR. Many, many EHR systems believe they should be the one owning the information that they collect from the hospital and from the patient. And they use this asset to generate their income. It's nothing wrong, but it is a fact that they treat data, patient data, hospital data, as their own asset. And you may have heard about that. There is a very famous analogy, someone saying that data is a new oil, right? oil is the asset, not only in a personal level, in a country level, every country wants more oil, right? But I think I heard from Dr. Long Chen, he has a more closer analogy that I believe what the data is. Data is a fire, not oil. With fire, it has two meanings. Fire meaning that if I have a fire, I pass the fire to you, you will have my fire, and then you can keep passing on. That means if I share my data to you, you can easily make a copy and become your own data and become your own asset. That's number one. And number two, fire, depending on how you use the fire, it can have the positive side. We all use fire to cook, for example, but fire can also burn down the whole house or even the whole forest. So I believe if you really think about that, what EHR is currently doing, we cannot blame them, but we need a better and newer and more modernized way, or even a revolutionized way to think about EHR. That's why, starting from this year, I become unemployed or entrepreneur because I start up a company exactly targeting for this problem. And my goal is to decentralize EHR so that patient can own back their own data. And at certain point, they can even generate their own data. And we keep talking about, hey, patient data is a privacy problem, right? But if you think about this, it's not only patient data as a privacy problem. When an AI company, a machine learning company, send their model so that their model can be trained, right? Their model could be compromised as well. So privacy, on one hand, if you think about data privacy is important, the model privacy that you protect, how the model would not be stolen by someone else, is also very important. And I know this is not a commercial time, so I'm not going to go deeper into what this company is doing, but my vision is to protect both sides, the data producer and data consumer, right? The data producer here is the patient, but the data consumer is the model producer. And then at the end, once the model getting trained, that model can also be monetized. And maybe the model consumer to benefit from this model can be back to the patient if we really take the real balance of both the data and also the model. So I think that's why like a privacy AI is something I believe is also very important and as the next step for like just AI and machine learning.
I have to share with you this anecdote, and I won't mention the actual person involved with it, but I've heard the anecdote of Joe Biden when he was vice president and was sitting next to the founder of an EHR company, and he was talking about how wonderful the 21st Century Cures Act would be in terms of discovering cures for cancer and rare diseases and such. And it'd be great, we'll be able to take your data, meaning from the EHR company, put it in a database, our researchers could access it, and we can do wonderful things in healthcare. And that founder turned to then vice president and said, what do you mean, your data? It's my data to use any way I want. And it was very interesting because my perception has always been, and I imagine most people's perception is that the data belongs to the patient first and foremost, and it is allowed to be used in their patient care by the various provider organizations or vendor organizations in ways that they have permission to use them based upon privacy rules and such. But I thought that anecdote was very insightful into thinking how some EHR vendors think about their relationship to the data that exists in the EHR. Another thing that you said is you talked about fire. And when you talk about interoperability and you talk about fire, I think of the HL7 fire standards. So it was really interesting how you brought that into the conversation. Yeah. But I'm going to switch a little bit and ask Mr. Cooper another question. What is the role of data governance play in protecting privacy, in particular PHI, and what is the impact of expanding interoperability on data governance?
It's a great question. And I think it ties back to exactly what we were discussing, or what Cupid was discussing. You know, we've seen that, you know, HHS's final interoperability rules released last year, a really good step forward to this notion of the patient ownership of data, that least at the right to access my data, to understand how it's being exchanged. We're seeing that similar concept around privacy, really core to our consumer privacy protections that are arising in Europe around GDPR or CCPA, that notion that it is the individual that has ownership or at least control or right to control how that data is used appropriately. So I'm really personally very, very excited about the direction we're headed as it relates to interoperability and privacy. And I think when we marry those two concepts of thinking about privacy and data ownership at the individual level, if we think about how we can extend that notion of the individual right, it's incredibly important to think about how governance brings that process together, often in the form of policy. So how do I start to apply policy appropriately to a set of classified data ship with a notion of people and ownership on top of that? So it's really, again, that intersection of people, process, and data really being driven in a practical way by where we're headed from an interoperability perspective that I think is challenging this old notion of data ownership, where that control resides. And I'm incredibly excited about what this means from a technology perspective to help us unlock interoperability by placing that control and that transparency in the individual's hands. If I know where my data is going, if I know how it's being used to support my care, I'm far more likely to be supportive of that process than concerned about how that data is being might be used against me in the future in the form of, you know, higher insurance rates or all of the ways that we can see data abused from a privacy perspective. So when we provide this transparency, it brings along that support for individuals to be more open to sharing of information, and it places that control where it should be, back with the individual who actually has the long-term benefit, the long-term damage that can be suffered from a violation of inappropriate use of that data.
Dr. Gabriel, what technologies do you think can improve interoperability, and how will they work?
As I mentioned, technology matured enough, but interoperability especially is not about the technology in the forefront. It's mainly about, I would use this analogy, it's mainly about you have two kids and maybe twin kids from the same parent. One kid grew up in a country A and the second one grew in a country B, and then the two kids meet at some point. If they don't speak the same language, they didn't grow up in the same environment, they don't understand the culture, the workflow, the process, the semantics, even though the two kids from the same parents, they were never going to understand each other. Same with the healthcare interoperability. I think we need to have the way and build the way the same way we have a smart highway or the same way we have some kind of a good banking system. We probably need to have this strong health network of translation, if you will, that will understand each other. I think that's where we at this point.
Mr. Cooper, do you have some suggestions you can share on how to get started on the road to good data governance in a world of increased interoperability?
Well, I think governance is very much that key to unlocking the challenge that Dr. Gable was just speaking about as it relates to semantic understanding and the ability to communicate. If we don't understand what things mean within our organization, we certainly can't begin to interoperate and share that understanding outside of organizations. So governance, whether it's internal to an individual organization or across organizational boundaries where interoperability becomes critical, we need to have the governance in place to not only define the semantics, but to define and understand the care process, the care workflow, again, as Dr. Gabriel was saying. So many of these challenges, I think, that are core to the vision of interoperability that I believe the industry is dreaming of, really can be unlocked by thinking about how do we align semantically? How do we align from an information organization and a workflow process? So again, really understanding the people, how we define the concepts within that, as well as the overall process that occurs throughout care delivery is, in my view, the key to unlocking interoperability or the remaining challenges that interoperability still faces so that we can have that transparency. And again, tying that back to a common understanding of the privacy associated with that and how that relates back to the individual themselves. So having that strong agreement and the ability to define those concepts and tie them back into our policy and our data is the key to interoperability.
Thank you. Mr. Chan, I know what an Iron Chef is, perhaps having watched too many Bobby Flay videos on the Food Network channel. That said, you shared with me that we should look to be an AI-run chef in an AI kitchen, a video you produced. What do you mean by that?
Actually, small minor correction. It's A Iron Chef in Data Kitchen. You know that, like the Iron Chef show, I love it just like you do, Dr. Chicken. It's one of my favorite shows because I love eating. And believe it or not, before I got my two kids, I and my wife will actually drive to New York just for food in Chinatown and drive all the way back, one day trip just for the food. So that's why you know that I love food. So when I get into the AI industry and this technology, I am thinking like, it is actually very much like what we are cooking, because I have a story. So let's say one day, two chefs has an argument, right? One said, hey, my dish is the greatest dish in this world because I have the freshest ingredient. And then the other chef disagreed and said, no, I actually have the like most secret recipe will make my dish the best, or at least better than you. You know that the two chefs argue of something that is both cannot win, right? Both fresh ingredient and secret recipe of how you cook a dish is very important to come up with a great dish, right? Think about AI is the same. In AI, data is the ingredient. You cannot throw some like garbage data and expect the algorithm will help you and give you like a model can predict everything. That doesn't make sense because it relies on the data. But at the same time, the algorithm is the recipe. How do you really cook that like a dish to the point that it can be consumed by people, by users, right? So these both are very important to cooperate together, and we cannot lose any one of them. So that's the risk that actually echoes back to our topic throughout the whole panel, right? Data governance, like where is the data? And is this data trustable? This is the ingredient. It provides the ingredient to cook a good dish. But on the other hand, you still need like some steps to cook that data. Otherwise, it will be just a waste of a very fresh and highly curated data. But you don't have a proper way to cook it, it's still not good for us to consume. So that's why I decided to produce a video called A Iron Chef. And basically is to use this analogy to walk through the seven different steps of like how to do from data collection all the way to the prediction of this AI algorithm.
There has been much talk about social determinants of health. This is especially true due to the health disparities seen during the pandemic in communities of color. Dr. Gabriel, can you share with us some of what researchers are using to do work on social determinants of health in your work?
Yeah, so of course, my organization, the firm or the Federal Electronic Health Modernization entity, is investing in social determinants of health at HL7, the standards of how do we represent the transportation insecurity, food insecurity, some other factor like stress and so forth and so on. But social determinants of health I see it plays a big, big role in the current crisis and future crisis as well. As you can imagine, first of all, you can use social determinants of health to understand the behavior of the community, the behavior of society before any crisis hits the community, based on their lifestyle, their health status, and disparities. You can predict pretty much the severity of the crisis. And accordingly, you can craft the intervention and craft the information campaign to protect the society, either at least if you are not going to prevent it, you can reduce the severity of the crisis. The end of the journey is also you can use social determinants of health to plan the logistic of the vaccination, plan the logistic of the continuing interventions. And for future help or future kind of mitigation, you can use social determinants of health for future prevention to reduce the severity of future crises as much as possible. So that's at a high level speaking how you can use social determinants of health to impact the crisis back.
Mr. Cooper, I want to go back to the data governance. So how does good data governance facilitate research and collaboration?
Well, as we talked about, it establishes that common understanding that addresses that semantic unknown Dr. Gabriel had spoken to. One of the foundations that we need to drive good research is a commonality and a common understanding of data that's available to support that research process. It's also important, as Cupid was saying, looking at how do we understand the quality of our ingredients that are feeding our research process. So being able to understand the freshness of that data, the completeness of that record, especially as we're starting to bring in much more diffuse data sets like social determinants of data that are not well quantified and not necessarily well understood. We need to have a common understanding of what that means for some of these new determinants that we're looking at, such as proximity to a food desert. How does that impact the research that I'm driving? What is my definition of a food desert? And does that cross across the population of data sets that I'm working with to drive my research? And ultimately, that collaboration needs to expand beyond any one institution, agency, or organization. We need to have a strong understanding of the concepts that we're working with, as well as how we are facilitating and driving that research. Ultimately, we also see that governance is critical to access and supporting that collaboration. As Cupid indicated, we have to have trust in our research partners. If I'm going to allow you to use my data, drive my car to do your research, I need trust that it's going to be returned safely, that you're going to use it in a responsible manner, and then ultimately it will continue to be accessible for my use as well. And I won't have my valuable asset, my data, damaged or impacted that would ultimately harm my research and the effort that I've invested to support that. So we see governance both on the aligning our understanding of the data that's being used, the challenges that we're facing, as well as reaching an agreement on how that data can be used across an extended research collaboration, both from a trust and an appropriate access perspective. Those are ways that we see governance really playing a key role as we start to establish broad sharing and collaboration with organizations. We need to have that framework that allows us to support the process and the people that ultimately the data, the research will drive.
Dr. Gabriel, you shared with me that you think lack of information made the pandemic worse in the US. What do you mean by that?
The first one that comes to everyone's mind is that, we didn't know that there is a something outside of the U.S.'s in terms of the spread of the pandemic. So that's one, the first lack of information. The second part of the information that we lacked is, the crisis came and the crisis hit all the our society. How much resources and how much spread do we have to mitigate the spread? That's again lack of information. The third layer of lacking information, of course, we didn't use social determinants of health to maybe predict to some degree early enough, to some degree that we have a certain area that can be prone of spreading the virus over others. I think hopefully that's a lesson learned for us in the next cycle that will address all those two different layers and prevent the severity of next crisis if it happens.
You know, we've heard such really great content today from all of our speakers, but I want to bring out two things that I walked away with that I thought were really important. The concept of learning to read implies data literacy. I thought that was a really great metaphor. And the idea that in order to produce a good meal in terms of analytics, you need to have good ingredients, and a good ingredient is having the right data. And when you want to do AI and machine learning, you also have to have good data. And I think if we walk away with any two concepts today, I think those are really wonderful ones to walk away with. Again, I want to thank Dr. Gabriel, Mr. Chan, and Mr. Cooper for their time today. I want to thank the audience for spending the time with us today. Everyone, really have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like more information on how Carisoft or Calibra can assist your organization, please visit www.carisoft.com or email us at calibra@carisoft.com. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.